Dr. Gregor Larson is a professor in the School of Archaeology at the University of Oxford and director of the Wellcome Trust Paleogenomics and Bioarchaeology Research Network. His research interests include evolutionary genomics, ancient DNA domestication, as well as human and animal dispersal. I'm going to ask you about that later because I have no idea what that means. His work on the domestication of canines and the origin of the domestic dog has provided insights into the prehistoric bond between humans and early dogs. Professor Larson, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Okay, let's jump straight into it. Here's the image of domestication that I believe most humans, including myself, kind of share. Somewhere in the distant past, we took certain animals and sort of craftily adapted their nature to suit our needs. Maybe we wanted them to help us hunt, like dogs, or we simply wanted to eat them on a sort of consistent basis. However, as I listened to a couple of conversations with you, you're talking more about a relationship between humans and certain animals, and quite a complex one at that. So what's really wrong with the simple one-sided image of domestication I described earlier?
Simple is great. Simple is fun. Simple is easy.
It is. I like simple.
Say, yeah. This is, and with simple is even better when we are kind of self-congratulating ourselves, right? Where it's like our ancestors were smart. They were goal-directed. They knew what they were doing. They looked around and they said, this will benefit our ancestors and our offspring, our progenitors. And so let's do this. This sounds great. And then you don't need to ask any more questions. We have what we have now, and we have that because some smart people before us decided that's what we were going to have. And now we're just living with that legacy. Sure. That sounds fantastic. The only issue with that is that there's zero evidence for any of it. So, you know, there is
zero evidence,
pretty much zero evidence. We layer on top of our own history, a desire for control, for meaning, for purpose. And then we go back and we see that. Or we don't. I mean, it's not there, but we see it, if you see what I mean. Like we kind of imbue it on top of the whatever record we're looking at, whether that's genetic or archaeological, or we sometimes just using it as a starting assumption. We say this is what must have happened, and so therefore let's gather the data to support that hypothesis.
I see. So gathering data to suit our narrative.
Yes.
And if
so, we come up with the narrative first, and then we go back and we say, oh, well, this is clearly what happened.
Okay, but a very simple, staying with simple, pushback could be these domesticated animals are here now with us and we're kind of breeding them. So, I mean, that's a little bit of a proof there for the simple theory, isn't it?
Is it proof or is it just a statement of fact, right? Like yes, there are animals around that we rely upon and they rely upon us to the same degree, right? I mean, there's 8 billion people plus now on the planet.
Yeah.
And our species is 300,000, give or take. So, and those 8 billion were only maybe a couple million globally about 12, 15,000 years ago. So that means for the 90% of our, more than 90% of our species history, we were just an afterthought on the planet. There was, you know, a couple million of us in various places, but we did not have any of these relationships. So now we have 8 billion. If you were to remove all domestic plants and animals from us, then that 8 billion would collapse very quickly. So we are just as reliant on them, as some populations of them anyway, as they are reliant upon us. So, but that doesn't mean that we, or that somebody 10, 11, 12,000 years ago, whatever, said, right, that we've been doing the same thing for the last 285,000 years. So let's just change everything up and that will be better for everybody in about 10,000 years.
Let's go to evidence then. We have the narrative, and the narrative that we have is not supported by evidence. What kind of narrative is supported by evidence?
Well, every animal and every plant is going to have a slightly different, there's context and there's a specificity around these things. So I'll tell you why I'm skeptical.
Okay.
If you know anything about rabbits, or if you...
I don't.
Right. Most people don't, right?
We had a chinchilla. At home. Is that any help?
It's not, but it's at least it kind of fits into the idea, right?
I appreciate your honesty.
I mean, New World, Old World, I guess, or at least Eurasia, South America. So the story about rabbits, that if you were to go on to say Wikipedia now or anywhere else for a long time, what happens is there is this narrative that there's a papal decree that happens in 600 AD And a guy named Pope Gregory decided that something called a loris, which is a word that means a fetal rabbit. So these are unborn rabbits in the wombs of female rabbits. And those unborn rabbits are called lorises. And what Pope Gregory said was that lorises were not considered meat during Lent, during the portion of the Catholic calendar during which you're not allowed to eat meat. On the basis of that, then, a whole bunch of monks who were in southern France and Spain said, ooh, we don't like this idea of not being allowed to eat meat during Lent. So if this is a kind of get out of jail free card here, if this is a free pass to have some animal protein, then sure, let's go grab some rabbits. Let's throw them into some hutches. Let's make sure that we'll wait till they're pregnant. And then when they are pregnant, let's harvest those fetal rabbits called lorises, and we can eat those as many as we want during Lent. Yeah. So then there you go. That's your, it's like a lovely just so story. It's a lovely Freakonomic story where it's the law of unintended consequences, where if the Pope says it's okay, now suddenly you get rabbit domestication and then we're done. End of story. What is interesting, and I am just as much at fault as anybody else on this, is that the first time I heard this story, I was like, wow, that seems totally plausible. Like what? And I've been studying domestication at that point for 15 years or thereabouts. And I didn't even blink. I just thought, okay, well, that's a really fun story. And so my decision was, well, if we know that it's 600 AD, why don't we then try and get some genomes from a variety of different modern populations and see if we can't use a molecular clock analysis using some genomic techniques to try and see if that tells us that 600 AD is that point. Because I mean, and how great would that be, right? We could then, we have this fact of 600 AD, that's when domestic rabbits start. It's very constrained in space and time. So let's see if we can recover that signal from the genomes. And if we can, that means the genomes have the power to prove a positive. So we can ground truth it. And then we can start applying it to things where we don't have a papal decree telling us that we aren't allowed to eat certain things during Lent. So when we had this idea and I had a master's student and we started looking into it, and I just said, well, maybe let's just get a reference for that papal decree. If it's a papal decree, I'm sure it's the church, right? They keep records. There will be some reference to or some paperwork or some document that we can point to. And it had been referenced at this point in the scientific literature, in the lay literature, in a lot of popular books about domestication. This whole idea was out there. So it wasn't going to be hard to find this. Other people will have done this. We just have to find the reference. And Evan Irving Pease was his name. And he came back 3 weeks later and he was like, small problem, Gregor. That papal decree doesn't exist. And I was like, what do you mean? Like, we can't find it? Like, it's there, but we can't get a copy of it or something is problem. And he's like, no, it actually doesn't exist. In fact, none of that, the reason it doesn't exist is because there was no papal decree. I was like, ah, that's different. So then what Evan did is he went back and he pieced together the story of rabbit domestication. And he started all the way back in the mid 7th century AD, where it's the first time you get this mention of lorises. And it was this guy, St. Gregory of Tours, so different Gregory completely. And he mentions that one person that he knew had mentioned the existence of these things called lorises. All he was saying in this document was, this appears to be a thing. It's a delicacy in the same way that, you know, delicacies all over the world, every culture will have something that everybody considers gross, but people eat anyway. It's almost, you kind of fetishize the disgusting. So in the same way, all St. Gregory was like, oh yeah, there's this thing called the loris. He didn't say anything about its popularity. He didn't say how frequently people were doing this. He mentioned nothing about whether people were eating this during Lent. There was nothing. It was just that existence.
Just a mention. That's it.
Just a mention. Then from that point on, again, starting then in the 20th century, when people start writing about this and writing about domestication a little bit more, you can follow the narrative as it morphs each time it gets retold. So it's like any great myth. People repeat it, but they tweak it, they embellish it, they add a little element to it, and it goes tick, 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 ratchets all the way up. And then the crucial point happens in about, I think it was early 20th or late 20th century, right around the 2000s, where there was, I think it was the Nature Conservancy website, made a switch between St. Gregory of Tours and Pope Gregory. So it's the same Gregory, or same name Gregory, but totally different people. As soon as you say Pope Gregory, now people then repeating it from their point say, oh, it was a papal decree. The point is, though, that there was not a single, the modern story as we tell it, there's not a single element of it that is true. It's all repeated, embellished fact that just gets layered upon layered all the way up through its most recent retelling about 10 years ago. And so what's curious to me is that when we say, well, okay, what do we actually know about rabbits? We don't know that. We don't know exactly when people and rabbits started associating. We don't know when their coat colors really started changing. We have some iconographic evidence for it, but we're not exactly sure where and when and how. We know that there's all these mentions of different relationships between people and rabbits. In the Mesolithic, there were some sites in Portugal where people were hunting them so that they represent something like 3/4 of all the bones at one site were rabbit bones. So people were clearly hunting quite a few of them. That's not domestication, but it is an association. So there is all of this myriad of interaction between humans and rabbits, which took a lot of different forms. And we start to see them being moved out of their native range in the sort of medieval era. We can kind of trace them as they move up through Northern Europe into the UK. And then they start to, they're associated with elites, and then they're common, and then they're out, and then they're invasive, and now they're in Australia. It just gets crazy, right? It's just this complete insanity of a repeating perpetual iterative cycle of a closening and then a tightening and then loosening of the relationship that people have where they really intensely focus on them, then they relax and they move them, and then they, it just, it's all, there's a lot more nuance and a lot more insanity around it, none of which involves anything to do with a Pope Gregory, a papal decree, a eating lorises during Lent, or that being the moment, the smoking gun, and the instant that domestication happened. It's almost, and so from my perspective, it's interesting, it's fascinating to me that we have to, we don't, we're not even aware that we're inventing a narrative about our awareness of domesticating something, right? What does that tell us? That tells us that we should be highly suspicious of the narratives we tell ourselves, even about animals that only came into this domesticated kind of living arrangement with us in the last 1,000 years. Much less things that happened to 10, 12, 13,000 years ago, or even older. So yes, those narratives suit us, and therefore we need to be extra suspicious, especially when it can be very clearly demonstrated that at least one of the major narratives has absolutely zero basis in fact and no credibility for even being remotely true. The issue with it for me too is that as soon as we tell that story, I bought it hook, line, and sinker. I completely fell for it. And I didn't question it at all. All I said was to the master student, go find the reference. I didn't think that it wasn't true. Of course it was true. And the reason I thought it was true is because it made sense. And if something makes sense, you don't question it. And that's the problem, is that our brains are wired in such a way to perceive the world in such a manner that if something makes sense, even if what is making sense is our own narrative layered upon a history which has no basis, in fact, we then don't question it. And therefore, it leaves this giant black space where we should be asking questions and should be interrogating the relationship, the time frame, the complexity, how everything moves around and what happens. But we don't, because somebody grabbed a couple of rabbits, threw them in a hutch because they didn't want to not have to eat or not eat meat during Lent. End of story.
So are you telling me that whether we're talking about cows, chickens, or dogs, domestication is just an empty vessel? There's nothing to rely on. There's nothing concrete in our hands. Or do we have any sort of archaeological evidence for any of these, as you call them, living arrangements?
Yes, there are more and more people looking at, there's a lot more data. The tools we have available to us now are so much better. They're just so much more robust, have such greater powers of resolution, especially when in combined in unison. But what we're finding each time we are applying these things is that the stories we've always told ourselves turn out to be either A, a lot more complicated, or B, completely false. So here's one of chickens. Why were chicken, and it's always the question that I get asked first, is like, why did we domesticate species X? So why did we domesticate chickens? We know what the answer is. It's super simple, right? They are the single most consumed meat. They've overtaken pork globally. They are, there's, by some estimates, 80 billion chickens on the planet, where it's just like at least 10 to 1 for every human, which it makes it by far the most numerous vertebrate and certainly the most numerous bird. And there's massive warehouses with tens of millions of birds that are all living very, very closely together. So, of course, the reason that we domesticated chickens was to eat them, right? That's why we did it. We eat them now, so we ate them then.
I mean, and this does make sense. We domesticated them, and then now we eat them. I mean,
yeah. So, and not only that, but we probably domesticated them a long time ago because they were so important. We recognized that they would be a tasty meal. So why would we not domesticate them as early as possible?
Exactly. Yes.
And it was just when people got to where red jungle fowl, which is the progenitor of domestic chickens, which is a relatively, I mean, it's a big area globally or, you know, regionally, but globally, it's a relatively small area of peninsular Southeast Asia, where you get four or five different subspecies of red jungle fowl. It's like people get there, they see them in the trees, like, ooh, yum. They grab them by their legs, they pull them down, they start eating them. Now we got 10,000.
Makes sense to me.
And so some of the early papers in the last decade or so have come forward with evidence for very early Neolithic chickens, not just in peninsular Southeast Asia, but in China and Bulgaria. And it's always led by, like, these were the first omelets. Or, you know, there's some consumption happening here. There's some use of those chickens as a foodstuff, as a source of protein for us, because that's what we do now. So that's what we did then. And that's the primary importance. All this other stuff, like chicken fancying, where you can grow them with really crazy feathers and crazy patterns of their stuff, that's just for like a small select group of people to make really fun calendars every year. So you can switch over, it says March, and you get a ridiculously wild bird. Although arguably that's another kind of way in which those chickens are associating with people, right? Another living arrangement. So, and we didn't, it would be probably laughed out of town if you said, well, we pulled them out of the trees 10,000 years ago so that we could play with their feather color and show off to our friends which ones we created and give them some really fun name, right? But we don't say that because we think that somehow there's a primacy of protein consumption that takes precedence over any other way in which we might interact with an animal. And I don't know, A, if that's true, but B, it turns out, firstly, that time frame is ridiculous. Again, nobody really looked at it until we're like, okay, big team of people, one primary guy, Joris Peters, who was like, I'm going to investigate every single chicken bone and every single archaeological site that has ever been claimed in any archaeological report or excavation. And that's what he did. He spent a decade doing this, just going everywhere. In some cases, finding the actual bones, if the bones didn't exist anymore, looking at the photographs, measuring everything, and doing the whole context. How many bones are there? Has it been directly radiocarbon dated? What is the rest of the faunal element there? What kind of farming are people doing if they're doing farming at these sites? What's the likelihood that this is actually just a red or gray jungle fowl because it's found in the range of the wild ancestor and been misinterpreted as a domestic chicken? And so he created two tables. A good table of chickens. We were like, those we're confident are chickens based upon these dozen criteria. And these that we are, if not outright dismissing, suspicious of. We just want to put a very high bar. It's not that they're not, but there's reasons to be worried about these. So we create these two lists. We then take a very conservative approach, go straight with the good table and say, let's create a map then of the first appearance of chickens we consider to be good on a global map, and then interpolate that map with a nice color scheme that shows the earliest ones in one color and then bleeding into a color that gets a bit darker. And the first thing you find, that far from being 10,000, the very earliest chickens that there are is only about 3,500 years ago. This is a very recent phenomenon. Secondly, it's happening in peninsular Southeast Asia. And then relatively quickly after that, over the next couple of centuries, they start moving with people across Eurasia and east into the Pacific, and they get to the Mediterranean, well, the Levant and the Mediterranean, say 800 BC, right around that time.
Really?
Yeah, it's very late.
Okay.
So what's curious about this too is, and that kind of, in some ways it fits because it's what we see in the Bible, like there's no chickens in the Old Testament, but there are chickens in the New Testament, and there's a good reason to think that maybe they're not in the Old Testament because they simply don't exist. And what's really interesting to me, and this was found out through a very careful analysis with Naomi Sykes and Julia Best and a number of other people who were looking at the actual archaeological context of where these chickens were found. Was it full burials? Were they whole skeletons? Were there cut marks? What else was there? Was there other grave goods that were part of this entire way in which you find the chicken? And what's fascinating is that chickens arrive, and for 500 years, there is no evidence of anybody eating them. Nothing. Nobody is eating chickens. They been in sort of a domestic human context for a good 2,000-3,000 years.
What about the eggs that they lay?
Eggs are questionable. Eggs really come to the fore in Roman times. You start to see a lot more concentration on the egg. It's not to say that people aren't, but we don't find big caches of eggshell. We don't find a lot of reference to people eating eggshells. We certainly don't see this idea. And what people have inferred that chickens were laying on a daily basis. There is some reference to this in some of the early literature, but it's not chickens they're actually referring to. It's probably ducks in Egypt, and whether it's daily or not is another issue. It gets sketchy.
So for 500 years, people were just like chilling with chickens, hanging out. I mean, what are we saying?
So think of it as like, well, there's a couple things. So I'm sure they exist in Japan, where you are now, but certainly in all major cities in the world, there's pigeons. They're everywhere.
Right.
People don't, are we eating them? Eh, maybe some people. Are they being tolerated because they're hanging out? Yeah. Are they being actively persecuted? Well, people put like anti-pigeon stuff, but nobody's so worried that we're trying to eradicate every single pigeon. They're kind of generally don't want them around thing behavior that we do, but we've just figured out that it's going to take too much time and effort to eliminate all of them. So with chickens are different because when they arrive, they're not from Europe. They're from peninsular Southeast Asia. And when they show up, you could imagine there's no other bird that looks like this, no other bird that acts like this, and no other bird that sounds like this. This is effectively an alien bird. And something that is from that far away, that has that many differences from what you're used to seeing, you venerate this kind of thing. This is amazing. This is effectively an alien, right? You're not going to eat. The first thing you're going to do when an alien lands, your first instinct is, I'm going to eat this thing, right? It's got a huge amount of popular appeal given its weirdness and given how unique it is in terms of all of its characteristics. Then, of course, it starts getting into religion. It gets associated with the Catholic Church, with the crowing and the rebirth and all kinds of other facets. You find it then start finding it on coins. It becomes a symbol of importance and general like high status things. It's the national symbol of the whole country of France, for Christ's sake, right? Like chickens were a very big deal precisely because they were so rare and from so far away, and you're not eating them. What's really curious, though, is that archaeologically what we see is about 500 years after they arrive, that's when you start to see some of the cut marks. That's when you start finding individual bones, which appears that they've been like slaughtered for meat, and people are starting to eat them. But again, even by 1000 AD, so this is now nearly 2000 years after they show up, they still are only less than 6% of the total faunal assemblage that you'll see on any archaeological site in Europe or in the UK. And it only doubles to 12% at around 1000 AD when, again, religiously, the idea was again associated with Lent or with just fasting in general, was that you were allowed to eat animals that had two legs but not four legs. And that was really strictly imposed at about 1000 AD. And then you start to see this increase, and then it starts to pick up from there. So it's not a sudden, explosive, instant thing. Chickens arrive, they're venerated, they're treated very differently, then they become a bit more common. And it's that classic thing where if you have something that's around and you're kind of used to it after a while, and you're born into a world with it, then it's no longer interesting. And then you're like, oh, maybe we'll just, you know, if we're hungry, oh, well, we could probably kill that thing and eat it. And so it's familiarity breeds contempt. And that familiarity will then also maybe breed consumption because you just don't care about it in the same way that your ancestors did. What I love about this story is that the clock is true no matter where you go. So when chickens first arrive into the Mediterranean, it takes 500 years. It then takes almost 1,000 years for them to get up to the northern climes of Scotland. When they first arrive in Scotland, everybody in Scotland goes, holy shit, what is this? This is amazing. People in Southern Europe are eating them, but in Scotland, this is brand new and amazing, and they treat it in the same way, and the clock then starts ticking. It takes 500 years for the Scots to start eating them. So it's this very clear pattern of initial arrival is weird, is unique, is different, and people react to it in that way. And then the familiarity comes in, and then you start to eat them. And again, on a very, very small scale. And they've only just overtaken pork as the most consumed meat globally. But if you look, even 150 or 100 years ago, 150 years ago, chickens were still paid so little attention to in terms of the amount of time and effort that farmers were putting into them, that it was really, especially in the US, really the purview of minorities and women who were allowed to look after chickens. All the men had the sheep, the goat, and the cow, and that's what they looked after. So it was just kind of an afterthought. It was a little extra money. It was a little thing that you would put on the side. So yes, we can start from the present, and we can say we eat more chickens than anything else, and therefore we can leap all the way back to the beginning, claim that beginning to be 10,000 years ago, and say we started eating chickens 10,000 years ago, and now we eat a whole lot of it now. The truth of the matter, though, is so much more complicated, so much more rich, so much more interesting, and so much in antithesis of that narrative that's what kind of haunts me but excites me at the same time as an academic, is that all of our stories are wrong, so let's go find out the true one. And what's great about it is just the degree to which we constantly make the same mistake, which is to assume that we can take the present and map it onto the past, when in fact, it's always changing. There's a dynamism, there's a huge number of things at play culturally, religiously, biologically, ecologically, conservation, where everything is changing all the time. And there's fads like anything else. And animals and plants are no different than anything else that you would think about in that perspective. So it gets really, it's a hell of a lot more complicated, but I just feel like it's so much more satisfying because it is actually the truth rather than this just pretend lie that we want to tell ourselves where we know everything. We're completely smart and intelligent. So are our ancestors. And this is exactly why we did everything, was just to maintain where we are right now. And it's just not true.
Okay, if we switch it up, that was a crazy story. I had no idea because I had that feeling that you described earlier that chickens are around since forever. You know, they're just part of our diet. For, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of years, which of course, yeah, now that you explained, doesn't make much sense. Okay, but let's switch it up to dogs. I think, Okay, first of all, I think most of my listeners will agree that this podcast is becoming renowned for asking preposterously basic questions sometimes, but I refuse to shy away from admitting when I'm clueless about something. So here's
the
thing.
That's the best way to learn. It's the only way to learn.
I agree. I cannot imagine the first steps in the beginning of this quite unbelievable relationship between humans and dogs. I mean, did a couple of wolves, if we know anything about that, did a couple of wolves just figure out that humans have food all the time? So they started chilling by the campfire regularly, thus making themselves less aggressive? Or did we catch a bunch of wolves randomly and then select the more gentle ones and keep those? Or was it something else entirely? Do we have anything backed by evidence that would tell us something about this crucial phase between dogs and us?
Right. No, is the short answer. We have nothing backed by
evidence.
But a bunch of stories. We have a bunch of stories. And some of those stories are predicated on that desire for control. Right. So the simplest story is X number of thousand years ago, say 20, 25,000 years ago, a couple of people saw some wolves. We're familiar with wolves. They're on the landscape just like them. They're probably hunting the same thing. And they thought, you know what? We know where those wolf dens are. So let's go grab a couple of puppies and bring them back and maybe even breastfeed them. Right. Like,
again,
but let's rear
makes
them.
Sense. Yes.
Makes sense. Let's rear them from a very early age because we know that if we take a wild wolf's puppy, we can raise it and there'll be this thing called a dog. think about that. If you were to do that with like a lion, which is not that dissimilar, right? Would you possibly go grab a lion cub and be like, I am confident that, or a tiger, talk to Siegfried and Roy about doing that with tigers, right? Like, it's like there's this whole, these, no, bad idea. And there's been study after study after study that have demonstrated things to do with critical period and socialization and just the way and fear responses and all this kind of thing. A hand-reared, human-reared wolf puppy is not a dog. These are very, very different things. And I don't care how many generations you think you get, then just to make sure you could keep them and then breed them together and keep the tamest ones, how many you got? Right? What do you got, 100 of them and you get to choose the 10? And where are you keeping them? And what are you feeding them? And why? This is some sort of controlled experiment where you can stake them and hold them down the whole time. Meanwhile, you don't have anything else to do. So the simplest story in this case sounds great. And then when you start to put it into practice, it falls apart for me instantly. The problem, though, is that any story when it comes to dogs falls apart instantly. And that's what's so fun about this is that anytime somebody goes, oh, well, how about this idea of wolves just coming around and hanging out? And it's like, okay, but how much waste would there have to be in order for them to sustain that population? And wouldn't humans just immediately chase them off? These are animals that they're competing for you on the landscape and they're actively dangerous. If you know how many dogs kill people in the UK right now, there's a huge thing about the bully X breed. And therefore, because there's all this press focus on attention, it seems like every 2 weeks, a bully X is biting someone or killing someone or maiming a toddler or whatever else. But it's not just the bully X. In the UK every year, there's dozens of people who either get seriously injured or killed from dogs. And we think a tame wolf is a good idea, right? So the kind of model that I like to use in this, though, is around the idea, like an evolutionary thing, where what we see is a lot of times animals will form or go down trajectories of evolution and behavior that have a lot to do with food, and that gets embedded into a culture. So there's this really great example of killer whales off the northwest coast of the Americas. So there's two main ways of living as a killer whale. You can either hunt marine mammals, seals and the like, or you eat salmon. Now, the two pods of killer whales that do this, when they have killer whale babies, they train them to eat those things. And there's very different styles of hunting. You've got to know where you have to be at certain times of year. You have to be able to communicate between each other about how to get them, especially if you're chasing seals. And you just, there's a huge amount of time and effort and learning that goes into procuring that specific kind of prey. The two populations are still killer whales. They're not, it's like, you know, they're effectively you and me in terms of our degree of distance. So there's nothing preventing them from mating and producing offspring, but they don't. It's human cultures. You know, think of the same thing. If we had to go to like Shakespeare with Montagues and Capulets, right? There's nothing stopping Romeo and Juliet except for the weight of culture around both of them, or sharks and jets, or whatever you want. And that is not insignificant. And so there's a good reason why there was no F1 hybrid between Romeo and Juliet. It wasn't because they were incapable of doing so. It was because their families were like over our dead bodies, and quite literally our dead bodies, right? So, and similarly with killer whales, and you can see it with a whole range of other animals, when you get one group of them starting to focus in on one particular resource and another group focusing on a different resource, that is the thin edge of a wedge, which will start to distinguish those two populations and start preventing gene flow between them. As soon as you start preventing that gene flow, now you can allow other things to layer on top of that to then further ratchet up the division between them, and then even more reducing the likelihood of gene flow between them. So in wolves, we have this. So there are wolves in Canada, a group of wolves that follow the caribou. That they're this caribou wolves, and they go up and down every year with a caribou migration, and they protect those caribou from other wolves, and they coordinate with each other about how to identify one that might be slightly lame, and they go after, they pick it off, and they're basically always in tow of these caribou. There's other wolves in the forest in Western Canada who don't really go that far, and they subsist on a diet that changes through the year, depending on what the forest is willing to give them. And they're very good at identifying where to go when certain things are available. Very much like, you know, our human ancestors were in changing climates and changing times of seasons during the year. When do you store stuff? When do you harvest stuff? Where to go at certain times? Those wolves occasionally will run into each other. And again, it's very similar. They look at each other. They recognize each other as wolves. They will be sometimes even friendly with each other, but they don't mate, or at least they mate very occasionally. It doesn't happen very often. So you're starting to get this thin edge of the wedge. So because of my general suspicion around top-down, human-led, it was us, we're smart, we went and did everything, and the demonstration that, at least with rabbits and with chickens and a host of other things, that that's not quite entirely true. I'm not saying that we weren't intentional in some ways, or there wasn't some part of a human making a decision at some point, but it certainly wasn't to domesticate. Nobody pulled a chicken out of a tree to eat it. That's not how this worked. So why would it be then, if you have no other domestic animals whatsoever, that you would grab a wolf puppy of all things? I mean, geez, at least a lamb is not going to eat you, right? Like it's crazy. So what I think is probably happening is that there is a relationship forming between a population, maybe two, maybe more populations of wolves, and a group of people where you start to get this association largely driven by some sort of food stroke resource availability shared thing. I don't know what that is. I don't know what that looks like. But if you can imagine that wolves then start following those people in the way that modern wolves will follow caribou, and then we become their caribou, then not only then are you severing the gene flow between those wolves and other wolves, but they're actively protecting us from their conspecifics, where they don't want any other wolves associating with us. And that starts to start this ratcheting process where they're getting closer to us and vice versa, so long as that process is happening as well. But at least you have an initiation of the severance of the gene flow. Whereas if you were just grabbing a puppy and you let it go out, why would it not hybridize with something else? And then those offspring are coming nowhere near us. So I just feel like there are evolutionary models that exist that don't require the first step of being somebody smart stealing a puppy. I'm not saying that there wasn't some kind of action like that involved at some stage, but I feel like to get there, to be the very first thing through the door, it's not intentional. There's got to be something else going on. And when one possibility, and we're kind of looking into this too, is that around the last glacial maximum, 20,000 or so, 22,000 years ago, certainly in Siberia, there's a few places where there are these kind of enclaves where it appears that they're not, those areas, those regions aren't being hit quite as hard by the cold and the ice and everything else. And what you're seeing in the run-up to that is a huge drop in the populations of a lot of large mammals. And wolves are no exception. They get absolutely hammered in terms of their total population size. And are paleontologically, they almost vanish off the landscape. So it could be that what you've got is a kind of climate forcing thing where you don't have a huge amount of space where everything can coexist and everything is a bit on the edge of their survivorship. And then you've got this kind of, it's almost like being forced on a blind date where you have this population of wolves and these population, they're all just in the same place. But what are we gonna do? I guess we'll just hang out for a while. And, you know, just maybe we'll, and then at the end of that, you may have formed this relationship, which was the basis for the process, which turned that population of wolves into dogs. And then from there, once that relationship starts, and this is what we see with the chickens come to people not the other way around because of this wet rice agriculture, the dry rice agriculture arrives in Peninsular Southeast Asia 3,500 years ago. That kind of ecological footprint involved with that sort of rice agriculture is just a huge magnet to the chickens because it looks a lot like the blooms that they saw with a lot of the other things that they were eating. So that draws them into a human niche. But once they're associated, it, you know, it's the classic thing, like come for one thing and stay for something else. So the chickens came for the dry rice, but once they were associated, then it was like, oh, you got millet, you got rice, you got wheat. Sure, we'll do that too, right? But it was the dry rice that brought them in. And then once they're associated with people, the grain ceases to matter. But you need that dry rice to get them in first place because that's where they are and that's where the dry rice is. And it's the same thing with wolves. Once you have dogs, now you go through this process where you can do anything. And look at what dogs do for us now, right? I mean, nobody would have grabbed a wolf puppy with the intent of putting it into an airport to sniff drugs coming from teenagers coming back from spring break in Mexico, right? That's not why people did that. But yet that's the same kind of rationale that we use whenever we impose that kind of top down, we did it for X, because why X and not Y or Z or a million other things. So I'm always curious and interested in what are the mechanisms that would allow something like this to happen that do not require a couple of very smart people X thousand years ago to just decide that a podcast in 20,000 years would be discussing it and they would get credit for it.
How very interesting. I like the story that it all began, this great love affair began with a reluctant first date from both sides. It does make some sort of intuitive sense, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, think about your own partners in the, throughout your life. Was
it was certainly a lot of reluctant dates there, yeah, from the other side. Yeah,
exactly. But, you know, how often is it that, you know, who chooses, who actively goes out and says, I'm going to steal you and you're going to be, okay, you know, sure.
It's terrifying. What I mean, yes.
But that's never romantic. That's not the romantic ideal, right? It's supposed to be a mutual thing, right? It's supposed to be two people meeting eyes across a room or whatever cliche you want to use. And that's a far more fun narrative. So why don't we apply that to our domestic animals and plants?
Right.
I mean, makes sense. We should be giving agency to these things as much as we have ourselves, because frankly, neither of us had any agency in the way in which this result happens. I mean, you hear this about, people say this about love, right? You don't choose who you love. You don't choose who you have you domesticate. Why should we?
Will you concede this, though, maybe in a form of a question? Did any other humans or hominins have this sort of relationship or domestication from both sides? Do we have any evidence of like Homo erectus or Neanderthals living in such proximity consistently with other animals?
Yeah, no, we really don't. But it kind of depends on what you're looking for. And often that's predicated upon a modern relationship. So, you know, we're looking for those signs that match the ones that we see in modern populations. So we're looking for like size change in the bones. We're looking for the male-female ratios in archaeological sites. We're looking for a preponderance of a particular species, which would indicate some way of interacting them, which is different than other what other populations do. So we don't really see, we see a lot of hunting with Neanderthals, and Heidelbergensis and with Erectus, and we see stone tools and we see breaking up bones to get to the marrow. We see, there's evidence of all of that, but
yeah.
Forming relationships that get this far into kind of mutual interdependence, which then gets reflected in the archaeological record, it's just not there. It's not to say that there weren't relationships. I mean, clearly there's a lot of way, if you're hunting something, you need to know how that animal and how those populations of animals behave so that you can manipulate that in a particular way. And people don't just manipulate the animals, they'll manipulate the landscape. There's pretty good evidence, or so I'm told, of people intentionally burning fires in certain places and times So not just to cajole animals into a certain place, but also then to encourage things like deer and other animals that like the early growth stuff to try and maximize the likelihood that you're going to find your prey of interest in a place and time. So people are manipulating landscapes and manipulating populations, absolutely. And not just, by people, I mean sort of
by
all
people
homo.
You mean, yeah, okay.
But when firstly, if we say, is there any evidence of that ticking over into a domestic relationship, we have to be careful of what we mean by that, because I think we all have an intuition around what that is, and that tends to mean things like tameness and control and things which aren't really demonstrated. And it's our intuitions that get us into trouble, because as I was saying, we invent stories when we don't even know we're inventing stories. So I suspect that there will have been a lot of knowledge and a lot of interactions between Homo and a lot of other animals and plants for that matter, but it not tipping over into what we would now refer to as interdependent relationships, where without them, both populations suffer.
Okay.
And that's kind of the thing, right? Because again, if you took all people away, there's a lot of corn that's not going to grow next year. And if you take all corn away, there's a lot of people that aren't going to grow next year. So it becomes this kind of mutual reliance, interdependent reliance.
But a small victory for us here, I have to say, just a tiny bit.
Yeah, small victory.
No, that we, I mean, there is something, I don't know if special is the right word, maybe exclusive about Homo sapiens that maybe, like you said, tipped us over for us to be able to participate in this relationship.
So we have to be careful about our language there too. I don't, tipping over makes it sound, if not neutral, then kind of mildly positive, like that was sort
mildly
of ordained.
Positive, yes, I'll take it. So
look around the world, right? What about this is necessarily positive? I feel like what we are as a species is we problem solve on day-to-day basis. So we're active, we're thinking, we have communication, we do have control over some of our activities and our faculties, but we're not solving for next year. Like this is, our species is very good on a short-term basis. Long-term thinking is not what we do. And we take for granted what we've got right now. So that what happens is that I think a lot of what is, and there's a lot of really great literature about this, especially early agriculture. This is not people actively deciding to cut stuff down and then replant it for next year so they had a stable resource. This is people being drawn back to that resource because they fell into it. It's an accident of becoming reliant upon something that they never wanted to. And in this way, the analogy is like your phone, right? I can't, at this point in 2024, I can't do anything on my computer if I didn't have a phone. If I was like, oh, I'm going off grid, I'm not doing anything. This two-factor authentication and my university means that even in my university, I have to have my phone to get a code to be able to log on to anything. Do I want to be this wedded to my technology? Maybe not. Do I have a choice in the matter? Absolutely not. Was it a plan 5 years ago to do? I didn't get a phone until what, 2003 or four or something? Did I think then that, oh yeah, now that I've got a phone, I'm going to live in a world where it's more free? Actually, no, it hems you in. It pulls you in and it just tightens the whole thing. So now you're absolutely constrained by the necessity of having one rather than the promise of all that was going to be possible before you had one.
Okay, speaking of phones and speaking of social media, I believe you will agree that social media has become sort of a relentless pit of abuse and loathing across the board. However, there is one exception. There is one exception though, and that's people sharing endearing pictures of or videos of their dogs. Nobody seems
and
to
cats,
be
and cats.
And cats, of course.
Actually, nope. Have you seen this one? The ones that I find that dog, if you're ever feeling down or you just want a good cry, and who among us doesn't want a good cry, right? If you want a good cry, type in like returning serviceman dog into Google or into YouTube.
Returning serviceman dog.
Yeah, okay, because what happens is all these people who are videoing when their husbands or wives or partners are coming from a tour of duty somewhere and they haven't seen their dogs for, you know, sometimes 18 months, 3 years, whatever. And they walk in the house and the dogs go absolutely apeshit in the best possible way. It's the most endearing, most loving, most like it's just heartstring pulling thing you've ever seen. And just one after another, after another, after another. The Basset Hound one is just outstanding because they just start howling. Like it's outstanding.
Okay. Case in point to what I was saying, nobody's impervious to that. So would you say that cliche that a dog is a man's best friend holds some truth to it? In other words, is this relationship between humans and dogs truly exceptional?
I think humans have an immense capacity for empathy. And often that empathy can be applied to anything. So yes, a lot of people absolutely love their dogs, but geez, talk to cat people, talk to chicken people, talk to pig people, right?
There's chicken people?
Oh my God. Talk to backyard chicken people. They all have completely independent personalities. They all do really interesting things. They behave in really interesting ways and they're smart. They know how to manipulate things. They know how to do things. And it's like they know how to manipulate people. Like they're fascinating. It's like anything. The more you get to know something, the more empathy you feel toward it, and the more you have a genuine kind of attraction and love and appreciation.
So you would say that dogs occupy a certain privileged position here of universal appeal.
You know, in South Korea only just got rid of dog farms for eating, right? And they did so out of international pressure, and that put a lot of people out of work and that kind of thing. Dogs have relationships with people that run the gamut. And the majority of dogs on Earth don't have names, aren't looked after, are kind of like your pigeons in Trafalgar Square. So I'm just wary of, in the same way we were talking about narrative, saying like all chickens came about because of X, in the same way that like all dogs have this relationship, when that can very much come from a very modern Western mentality of that it has to be a breed, it has to sleep in your house, and it's not allowed to do any actual work, right? Like, and that is a very novel, very interesting way in which dogs and groups of modern people have interacted that really doesn't have much of a historical analogy.
It does seem more universal that people like furry animals, like cats and dogs, as opposed to tarantulas. That's like a very niche thing, you know? Like, even when you travel, whatever continent you go to, there, it's very rare to find people who are like into tarantulas as pets. However, it's very common to find, you know, people who are dog lovers or cat lovers or whatever. I'm just trying to force you to say that there's maybe something else going on here, or that we feel some sort of natural affinity for dogs or cats, maybe.
If we do, I think it's a numbers game. I don't think it's because there's anything inherent in those animals that is different from our capability to feel empathy and feel a love, for lack of a better word, toward just about anything else that we share our lives with. Right? What is that? Was it a Rick and Morty line that all love is proximity plus time? Right? You have something very close by for a long period of time, you're going to fall in love with it. That could be an inanimate object,
that does make some sense. Yeah.
That's what happens. And I think because there's a lot more dogs than there are tarantulas, you're going to get a lot more people expressing their feelings about their dogs on YouTube. I don't know that like it's all, but fundamentally, I don't think it's that different.
Okay. But when you see like a little puppy, I always thought maybe that's some sort of evolutionary thing that they acquired to make us adopt and take care of them because they're so cute. I mean, it does seem, I'm not deciding that they're cute when I see like a puppy. They're just like,
absolutely not. And I'm sure that there is, again, that kind of built-in empathy for juvenile creatures, the big eyes, all the ratios of the head, the large eyes, the small, the domed skull.
Right. I mean, a baby tarantula doesn't have the same effect on me.
Perhaps not, but again, proximity plus time, right? I don't know if it needs to. And you can make an argument that a lot of ugly dogs get just as much love. They just had the ugly dog contest, the annual one, right? It was, you know, Chinese Cresteds who just look absolutely hideous, but it goes, oh, look how ugly it is. Oh, you know, like you can still get that. It's like you can cry because something very happy or very sad. You can have a love for something even if it's not phenotypically super attractive. A colleague of mine did a study a few years ago that was really fascinating where he correlated the timing of street dogs in Central America from when their mothers were most likely to kind of abandon them with the timing of when people thought that they were the cutest and therefore most willing to adopt them, with the timing of when they were most vulnerable without human attention. And it all lines up. It's really interesting. So that it behooves the puppies to look super cute just as when their mothers are ditching them and when they absolutely still need care, but the mothers aren't ones to do it. And then people go, oh, I want to adopt this and bring it home, right? So there's this neat, there is a parallel there. And there's a lot of really interesting things going on where they're kind of leveraging or weaponizing our empathy as a human to imprint upon them in the way that then they would imprint upon us. And then you're starting to form this relationship. But that's also because we know that the relationship exists. Like you might, if it was something else that, and say dogs and this wolf human thing had never really, had never emerged in dogs, then the dogs wouldn't be there for us to have this feelings toward, right? So we have to be careful of that. Like it's a circular reasoning to say that because we're attracted to dogs, we must have domesticated them. It's like, well, if they hadn't been domesticated, then we wouldn't be attracted to them because they wouldn't exist. Because it's the relationship that formed them in the first place.
Yeah, no, I just passed a pet shop right now, and it's always like, it's always buzzing. There's old people, young people, everybody's attracted to the young puppies. They come in the shop. It's always super crowded. The dogs are running immediately towards people. It just seems, I don't like the word natural, but it just seems seamless in a way. I don't know. Yeah. That the relationship has always been there, and then the puppies are cute, so we take them, and then, I don't know. Yeah, stories, I suppose.
Yeah, good stories.
Good
story. And you know, it wasn't there for 300,000 years, and then it was. So
right. Okay, let's not forget about cats. Is the old adage that cats domesticated us to conquer the world legit? Again, if we look one look at the internet, any internet, and I think we will have to admit a bit of a yes there, maybe.
Ah, bullshit.
Okay.
So my issue with privileging one side of the relationship or the other, you're making the same mistake.
I see.
If we domesticate something, that's just as bad as saying cats domesticate us. It's funny. It's a nice inversion and therefore humor, but equally untrue. Like there's like, again, it's the relationship and how that relationship forms.
So it always takes both sides. Is that what we're saying, basically?
And so that's my argument. And for every animal that we have really investigated, that's what's happening. Which is not to say that there aren't times when people are making deliberate decisions to manipulate the population structure, but there will be a period of time before anybody's making decisions about stuff, which is absolutely critical in forming that relationship and that intentionality, or that the basis for that intentionality is predicated upon a reliance upon it that would have formed without any intention. I think that's clear, but probably not. So it's like,
no, not really.
So if we take, let's say, cattle.
Sorry, a cow.
There is, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so cow is a female. So that's why you want to say cattle. So it's both. But like,
yeah.
So what's interesting is that the common conception is there are cows or cattle, and people take them and they stake them and boom, you've got domestication. When in fact, what it is looking more like is that you already have a relationship, and it may very well have been a hunting relationship, but people are following these animals, especially if they're migratory, where you're going high latitude during the summer, lower latitude during the winter. And you know where these herds are going. And very much like the wolves are picking off the caribou, you've got people picking off some of the sheep and the goat, and they're following them around. And then as people, for other reasons, are constrained to staying in one place, they cannot allow those animals now to keep moving. So then they start bringing them to them. And that's maybe when the staking and the corralling and the penning them happens. But that's not happening in a vacuum. They're penning them because they're already reliant upon them. And the reliance is because they've already formed a relationship with them. And that's what's really interesting to me, is looking at the archaeological record for evidence of those relationships that precede the things that most people think of as the beginning of domestication.
If we extrapolate this to cats, what could have happened here at the beginning of the relationship?
Yeah, so we've got a fun story about this. We're still working on the paper. It's not out yet, but basically, the story of cats, 10,000, no. Cats are also very,
but they're in,
very...
In ancient Egypt, at least, right?
Yeah, so Egypt is looking good. And what's curious about it is that in this case, without giving too much away, because we're still in the process.
No, you can give too much away. No problem.
Well, I know. We're in the process of publishing, so there's the whole embargo thing and everything else. But
give us a little bit, yes.
So a little teaser is that if you think about the relationships and how and why they're forming, so you can get sorts of things like if red jungle fowl they like the grain that's being harvested, and so they're kind of they're being attracted to the people. Or in the case of people, sheep, goat, and cattle, where we're kind of following them around a landscape, and then if we're no longer able to do that as much for other reasons, then we start penning them. Or in the case of chickens, once they get to Europe, then there's changes socially in terms of the behavior of the governments and what you're allowed to do because of the religious forcing of different dietary restrictions over the course of the year. So that's going to start altering your behavior about how you interact with animals. When you interact with them and that starts changing their population sizes and the closeness with which you are doing that, that's going to alter that behavior. And it looks like there are some really interesting things happening in Egypt around there's a goddess called Best, and there are people who follow her, and there are temples that they go every year to, and they pay an homage, and they pay an homage in the form of a mummified cat. And this is requiring a huge production of cats to meet the demand for mummified cats to present as gifts to the goddess Bast.
And how did they choose the cat? I mean, why cat? Why not something else?
Right. So for a long time, Bast was portrayed with a lion head. Yeah. And then right about the time, then there's a shift. So it's still a felid, but then it gets into the North African wildcat. So there's just a cultural shift in the way that Bast is portrayed and the animal with which she is associated. And however that happens, I'm uncertain. But once that happens, people then start effectively murdering lots and lots and lots of cats in order to put them into mummified packaging so you can then deliver it like you would if you went to a church now, you buy a candle and you put it up at the front in memory of someone. This is the same thing, only it's a mummified cat. But in order to do so, you need a lot of cats. And so you get as this huge production for these cats that then ends up bringing them in much closer relationship. We get a much bigger population and much closer association with people. And that starts to change the way in which they're hanging out with people. And because they form that relationship, get much closer, then as people start moving, they start taking them with them. And now you start getting cats spreading all over the world.
Wow. So it always comes down to basically proximity and then an explosion of these species and then some sort of weird social reason for their proliferation and then becoming our pets or I don't know, food or whatever. Okay.
Social, religious, community, connectivity, identity, all they get wrapped up into the kind of the human tornado of meaning. And in so doing, become important for one reason or another. And then that's when you start getting really fun stuff happening. So people going, I don't just want a pig, I want a black pig. And we have this all this really fun evidence where in three different places in the world, independently, there have been different people with pigs already who a black pig popped up and they're like, ooh, lovely. We love our penchant for novelty. So they start selecting exclusively for the black pigs. And then those black pigs start moving out everywhere and they get called different things. But genetically, they're all black on the outside, but genetically, it's all a different mechanism that gets them to black. But demonstrating, therefore, that it's three completely independent instances of people going, love that black one. The other one, white we love, spotted we love, stripey, anything that's kind of unusual. This penchant for novelty means whoosh. And if we can, we start exploring the possible space biologically and shape-wise. So look at dogs now. My favorite stat from I was working with a high school student on this great project where he started looking at the Kennel Club books, the American Kennel Club books in DC, or sorry, in New York. And the very first book that he could get was 1905. And we said, okay, what is, when you look at the breed standards, let's write down all the numbers rather than the kind, there's lots of things like it needs to have kind of a dome skull, but it's hard to measure that. So we're like, let's just go for the things that we can absolutely measure. So let's write down every time somebody said what the breed standard was in terms of its size and its height. And the biggest breed, that the size that was not just allowed for, but like aimed for, the biggest breed in 1905 was 100 pounds, and the smallest one was 30 pounds. Now, last year, the biggest one was 220 pounds, and the smallest one, I think, was like 12 pounds. So a standard, which is supposed to fix things, keep that in mind, right? We're supposed to say this is what it should always be, and all it does is just expand away from it. And the biggest dog in just over 100 years has now doubled in the AKC books. And that's just amazing to me because what it demonstrates is that, again, it's that hunt for novelty. It's that interesting new thing. And a lot of that is gigantism and dwarfism. And we see that in cattle. We see it in horses. We see it in cats. We're seeing it in dogs. You just name your animal. If people start playing with it, one of the first things we start doing is going, let's just see what's biologically possible. How big can we make this?
How big or how small can we make this?
Or how small, right? Or how short can the legs be? Or how long can its ears be? Or whatever. Let's take a trait and maximize or minimize the crap out of it. Or make it somewhat different, like the Selkirk Rex. Let's have the cats where the ears fold over because that's kind of cute and fun and recognizable instantly. Sure, there's one kitten that did that. So they backcross it to make an entire breeding line of cats that do that. Never mind that they've got all kinds of other things wrong with them as well. It's fun to look at and then you can claim that you've got a Selkirk Rex. Great. But this is all after the fact. This is only after the relationship. That's what I mean. You get these concurrent stages of the relationship forms through interesting reasons, as you've rightly said, like kind of weird human, societal, cultural, religious, whatever. There's or hunting or some way in which these relationships are forming. Once they form, that provides the platform for us to express our own weird desires for novelty and fun with a whole variety of all the different varieties, and then they just go everywhere.
Okay, I know you have to go. I have you here you're a total expert, a scholar of these things. I need a clip for social media. So let's settle this once and for all. Which one is better, dogs or cats?
I can't sit on the fence. I really want to sit on the fence.
No, you can't sit on the fence. Absolutely not.
Sit on the fence. Let me sit on the fence. Let me sit on the fence.
There is no fence. I'm sorry.
A cow. Just throw rats on there. Why not? We did a study on rats. Rats are fascinating. There's all kinds of crazy stuff going on with rats. The black brown thing. Nobody knows about that, and that's just amazing, right? Anyway, you're going to force me to choose between a dog and a cat. I mean, I'd have to go with the dog, I guess, but I very, very reluctantly. Nice. This is like 50.1 versus 49.9, right? Like, it's like choosing your kids or choosing your breakfast cereal.
But you did say dogs. You did say
fine. Fine. If you need this essentialist, absolutely finite.
I'm terrible. I'm so sorry. I had to do this just for the fun of it. This was such an amazing conversation. My mind is blown. I wish we could do this again because I have so many more questions. We just scratched the surface here. But it was a really, really cool conversation. Thank you for taking the time. Professor Larson, do you have any social media? Where can people follow your work?
I probably should. I left Twitter after that. Anyway.
No, you can say it. Please do.
I ethically, I'm torn with social media because exactly as you describe, right? You said earlier that it's like this cesspool of hate and nastiness, but it's a great way of connecting with like-minded people who share their stuff and support each other. And
fair enough.
Well, I'm really torn. I was on Twitter for a while and I've never been on any of the others, but I think I'm on Blue Sky now, but ish only, I don't know, mental health wise, it'd be like 1 o'clock in the morning and my screen, I'd be scrolling. So right now, just email me if you want to get in touch. But we have a website for paleomarden.com. That's a website for our lab. We keep it mostly up to date. We got papers coming out all the time. And I'm on the various YouTube channels doing lots of various things. Always, I was a guest, not as like a promoting. Although I have done a couple of songs that you can check out about domestic animals. There's a chicken song out there somewhere. Another one about obligate synanthropes. But anyway, so find me where you can find me. And I'm happy to answer any questions you've got.
Okay. Very last thing. I just saw this recently. There was like a headless chicken that was alive for like a year or something. And they showed it around. What was that? I mean, how is that possible? I'm sorry. I don't know where this came from right now, but I just wanted to ask you if you're familiar with this.
It's quite old, actually, and it's happened on a couple of occasions. I mean, there's also the 1920s in America, and it was in Pennsylvania, the guy who got the railroad spike through his head, clean through his head.
Yeah.
So, just because you have significant brain damage doesn't necessarily kill you. Usually it does, but in the cases where it doesn't, it gets interesting. And my understanding of what happened with chicken is that they were trying to slice its head off, but went a little high, and all the basal functioning of what the brain was doing in terms of like walking, breathing, whatever else, were all still intact. And so the chicken just retained enough of its brain matter to remain alive for hours. And then of course they made sure it didn't get an infection or whatever else, because they thought it was interesting.
Yeah.
But it was only by like a millimeter, 1 millimeter lower, it's dead.
Oh, right. Okay. What a great way to conclude the show. Again, thank you so much. This was truly a pleasure.
Thank you. Yeah, it's always a thrill.
Thank you so much for listening. If you liked what you heard, please consider subscribing to Smart Cookies on YouTube. What else is there? Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And if you really liked what you heard, feel free to become my patron on Patreon by going to Patreon and becoming my patron. It's really easy. Just type Smart Cookies Podcast in there. You should be able to find me. Last but not least, I have to thank the absolute legends that are my producers on this show, my existing patrons on Patreon: Aida, Mancian, Micha Medved, Medinho, Gordon, Jurechuk, Lorenzo, Mila, Carmen, Taichi, Goran, and Veronica. Without you guys, this show wouldn't exist. So massive thanks. See you in the next episode. Bye.